Faut pas qu'on dise, tu sens la côte. Et tu te regardes, et tu te fais dire, le temps est venu.
Hi, my name is Gabriel Simeon, reporting for John Emmett on the air on CKUT 90.3 FM. When I say the word photography, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Is it the brand of a camera? Is it the different kind of lens? Or maybe a well-known photographer you know? Because for me, it has to be the word memories. Cameras have been around for a very long time. In fact, the first time someone ever used a camera was in the year 1826 by French scientist Joseph Nicéphore Niépce.
There was a man named Louis-Jacques Mandé Daguerre in Paris who was experimenting with the idea of photography at the same time. And on the 7th of January 1839, it was published in the Paris press that he had created a photographic process and that the images were little miracles in and of themselves.
Nearly 200 years ago, someone decided they wanted to capture a moment in time for everyone to see. From that day forward, Niépce started working on other ways to make photography easier. In 1833, he sadly passed away, but the advancements of cameras didn't. For many years to come, the camera started to get better and better. The camera became more portable, easier to use, and much more accessible to the public. In 1888, the first Kodak camera was introduced to the public, making it the first ever simple and portable camera that could be used by any amateur photographer. In the year 1948, Polaroid came out with the new type of camera technology, instant image development. This new technology made it easier for people to see what their pictures look like sooner, rather than having to have them developed over a long period of time. In 1991, Nikon came out with the first ever professional digital camera, which is what many professionals use today, including myself, even though I wouldn't consider myself a pro just yet. In the year 2000, humanity was introduced to the first ever camera phone. Samsung came out with the first true camera phone in June of the year 2000. Since then, cameras and phones have gotten better and better. Photography can be very fun, yet sometimes very challenging due to all the technical aspects that go into taking a picture. If you're using a Canon camera, for example, each camera has many different options and settings that can be changed. The most important aspect when it comes to taking pictures is the exposure, which means how much light there is in the picture. When it comes to adjusting the exposure, there are three main settings that can be changed. There's shutter speed, aperture, and ISO. Just to briefly explain what each one means, shutter speed is the speed at which the picture is taken. Aperture is how much light is being let in while making the sensor more or less visible, and ISO is how much artificial light there is, which would cause the picture to be more or less grainy. If you're worried about these settings being too complicated to learn and you just don't feel like dealing with all those individual settings, you can always change your camera to auto and have the camera make all the decisions for you. Cameras also have different types of lenses for different types of pictures. For example, a 50mm prime lens is usually used for street photography, since it's the closest thing to the way the human eyes see. A prime lens is a lens that doesn't zoom in. It's fixed at a specific focal length, which in this case was a 50mm. A zoom lens, on the other hand, is exactly what it sounds like. A lens that zooms in from one length to another. A lens like that can have a zoom anywhere from 16 to 35mm, all the way to a 70mm to 200mm. There's always a lens for any occasion. There are also different types of cameras when it comes to the internal aspects. The two main types of cameras that people use nowadays are mirrorless cameras and DSLR cameras. DSLR stands for Digital Single Lens Reflex, which means it has a mirror that reflects the image to the viewfinder. A mirrorless camera is exactly what the name entails. It doesn't have a mirror, which means the viewfinder is another small screen which shows what the sensor is seeing. Each of these cameras have their pros and their cons. For example, a DSLR camera is more expensive than a mirrorless camera, but on the other hand, mirrorless cameras have a smaller battery life. Research is key when you're on the look for a camera due to the amount of options and features one camera could have over another. While all this may sound fun and easy, cameras are still super expensive. This price can vary depending on which type you buy, like mentioned before, and from which company. For example, If you just want to have a simple point-shoot camera that doesn't need all the fancy exposure settings, then you're looking at spending about $200 max. A top-of-the-line camera, however, can go from anywhere from about $800 to $10,000. And that's not even including the lens, which in some cases can be more expensive than the camera itself. An example of this is pretty much every Sony camera and lens. Let me give you a scenario. If one day you decide to become a wildlife photographer because you simply love animals and you decide to go to Sony and buy a camera from them, a good camera for wildlife photography would be the Sony A7R Mark IV. It has great image quality and it's perfect for what you want to do. But the camera is about $4,000 and you haven't even bought the lens yet. And in this case, you'll need to buy a lens that zooms in a lot. So you decide to buy their 600mm prime lens for the amazing price of just $16,000. So before you decide on picking up photography as a new hobby, be prepared to spend a lot of money. I first got into photography after watching videos on street photography. I then decided to search through my entire house and managed to find an old 2008 camera, and I've been using that ever since. All of last summer, I would go out for walks and take pictures of anything I saw. In the beginning, the results weren't the best, but over time, they got better. Since I started photography, I realized that a lot of my friends like it as well, and I figured that they would be perfect for this assignment. So I asked all of them what got them into photography and why they like it so much, and here's what they had to say.
Hello, my name is Henry Blanco Stegley. Photography is an art and a medium that offers so many possibilities for creative expression, technical expertise, and a sheer variety of ways to capture an image. Age is not a barrier to learning to take pictures, and you can start with the camera on your phone. Due to the fact that I travel extensively, I want to share through this art form a moment of light in time, for that is what photography is, the capture of light. That light that shines off a person's face, a building, a landscape, to capture the emotion evoking rays of light that tell a story and the ability to share those stories with many people from all walks of life and interests is the motivation that keeps me captivated by this wonderful medium. Anyone can take a picture. The goal is for that picture to capture a moment in time, tell a story, and evoke the emotions within yourself and the people you share it with. Whether indoors or outdoors, look at life through the shutter and see the hidden jewels.
I find photography so cool because it can make anything interesting. It can be a way to capture a moment forever. It can also be a way to tell a story. It can also bring out emotions such as happiness, sadness, fear, and my favorite, nostalgia. And with the accessibility of cameras on our phones today, it makes it so much more easier, and really anyone can do it.
Today, I'm accompanied by one of my friends, Jane. She's the reason I got into photography in the first place. So thanks for being on this show. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks for asking.
So, what got you into photography in the first place, and why do you like it so much?
So, I think what interests me most about photography, and also probably why I got into it today, is its ability to capture moments in time. From the images that I have taken, I love looking back and reminiscing on something which I could have easily forgotten about. There's also at times when the camera catches something so amazing which you hadn't seen before, but in post-production, it just all comes together. Photography is also a great way to reflect upon history and the moments which have brought us to today. It's truly quite fascinating. I suggest anyone to try it out because you can be very impressed with what your camera can see.
You know, I gotta agree with that. Cameras really do help capture a moment in time. Seems like that's all the time we have for today. Thanks again for being on the show and telling us your story about photography.
Thanks for having me.
Photography. A very complicated yet somehow easy activity for people that love capturing moments in time. Cameras can be annoying from time to time, but at the end of the day, the results are always worth it. Photography is something that anyone can pick up and has been made much easier with the vast selection of cameras for sale in an ever-expanding market. After listening to this documentary, I'll ask you again, what's the first word that comes to mind when I say the word photography? Is it still the brand of camera, or is it something with more meaning?
Do you think you have what it takes to be a professional angler? Anglers, also known as fishermen, can make thousands of dollars fishing in tournaments. It's a sport that takes a lot of time and practice to perfect. But if you're willing to put in the time and effort, you can also become a pro. A lot of people think that fishing is a lazy sport. I disagree. My father is a professional angler himself, and I've seen the work and effort he puts into it. In fact, as I was writing the script, he's out looking for good spots to fish. To be a professional fisherman, there are a couple things you need to know. First is the technique. When I was young, fishing with my father, he would always tell me to tug, tug, and pull. Now, I know that may sound a little weird, but this worked very well. This is the simplest way to make your bait look like it's real. Next is to know where the fish are. A great spot on lakes is often under lily pads where a bass just waiting to pounce on your bait. A lot of the time, you won't find most fish just swimming in the open water. Rather, you'd find them hiding in the shade under tree trunks and lily pads where they make their nests. Knowing a lot about the type of fish and bait that works on them best is also quite crucial. There's many different ways to learn what bait works for what type of fish. There's magazines that have tons of info. The internet is a great place for looking stuff up. But the best way to find what works is asking experienced fishermen. Going to shops that sell all sorts of fishing equipment and asking around is great for learning new tips and tricks that can help you a lot in fishing. The final thing you need to know is people. If you can make good relations with people in the industry, it could be a lot easier to find companies to sponsor you and also get into tournaments in the first place. I interviewed a few pro anglers and I got a couple tips from them and some insight on how they got into fishing. The first angler I interviewed is named Steve Garcia. Here's the interview with him. For the first question, how old were you when you started doing tournaments?
Well, I started right now I'm 45 years old. And I started at 37 years. My first series was 37. It's 8 years ago that I started doing serious tournaments. I jumped right in and as a co-angler, and I started to work with a buddy of mine, and we never stopped. For 5-6 years in a row, all we did is tournaments.
Wow.
A bunch of series and walk-ons and one-day tournaments, and we did a few trails together.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Have any companies sponsored you for fishing in tournaments?
Yeah. Well, I have a big sponsor. It's the name of the company. It's a David Bryant Agency, and they're a big company, and I'm sponsored with Quantum Zebco Fishing. Quantum Fishing.
Oh yeah.
So it's a big. Rear and rod company, and they sponsor me. I have them. I have Strike King. I have a Flambeau. I have Dumbs. It's Dumsy Lures. I have a P-Line sponsoring me. Beckman Nets also sponsors me. So it's a bunch of gifts that I get from them. And
Do you have anything to say to people that might want to start out, try professional fishing or fishing in tournaments?
Like, well, for sure,
tips,
like
tips and tricks that you could give to, I guess, beginners.
Yeah, well, it's all about the love of fishing. Eh? You gotta have passion. If you have passion, and it's that's what you love doing, fishing, because fishing anglers, it's like it's in their blood. Eh? You gotta dream of fishing every day. It's you gotta be on the water like every single day. When you go to bed, you can't sleep at night because all you're thinking of is fishing the next day and catching the fishes. That's you have to love it. You know, you have to love competing also. It's about tournaments. You have to love competing. You're not on your own. Eh? Mm-hmm. So you have to like competing against other anglers. And you got to have the most love is the rush of adrenaline it gives you when you catch a fish on your line during your tournament. It's something you can't imagine. The pumping of blood and love for the fishing. And it's spending lots of time on the water, for sure. Like
of course,
you have to spend lots of time on the water, and you got to learn every technique of fishing. To become a professional angler, that's what you got to do. You can't go into a tournament with a one-trick pony. You got to know every technique And that's the way you got to start. And the most of all, what you got to do also is, you know, like when you start, when you're young, you know, you join some fishing clubs. That's also good. It's joining some fishing clubs. And then you learn how to compete in, you know, you got to learn how to compete in fishing organizations as a co-angler. That's the way I started. When I started competing, I was a co-angler. I fished with one of my friends, and he was like 25 years older than me, and he brought me under his arm, and that's the way I learned. You got to learn with the older guys, the most experienced guys, and mostly you got to learn from every different angler. It's every angler is different. So the most, when you fish with different anglers, it's the best trick I could give is fishing with a lot of anglers, because you got to learn a lot with that.
That was my interview with Steve Garcia, a professional angler. And the other two anglers I interviewed are named Malcolm Jacobs and Jacques Sauvet. And here are my interviews with them. Okay, so for the first question is, how did you get to where you are as a professional fisherman?
Well, it all started about 14 years ago. I was working in a fishing store part-time, and I got to know a lot of people in the industry with the product manufacturers. And over time, built a relationship with those people, and they offered sponsorship. I took them up on it. I started to do our first season of tournaments with a company by the name of St. Croix Fishing. And then after the second year, we were approached by a much bigger company, Shimano, G. Loomis, Power Pro, and Jackal, who approached myself and my partner to see if we want to work for them, as they were looking for reps in the area. So we decided to sign with them, and we've been with them ever since. Fishing tournaments, we started off with smaller open tournaments where pretty well anyone could show up with a boat and get in. And then we gradually graduated to higher levels until we got to the senior circuit, where we were fishing against pros that fish all across the U.S. and Canada combined, which was quite the challenge.
Do you think anyone could be a professional fisherman?
Yep, definitely. First and foremost, you have to enjoy fishing. You have to enjoy the outdoors. You have to be a bit competitive. If any of those three are you, then definitely you can be a professional fisherman. It takes a lot of practice, a lot of research to know where to go, what the fish want to eat, their habitat. Once you know those things, catching them is the easy part. It's finding where they are. I mean, the rule of thumb is 90% of the fish are in 10% of the lake. So if the lake is, 10 square miles, that means there's a lot of empty water to fish through before you find the fish. So practice, practice, practice.
How much do you think you can make fishing in tournaments?
All depends. If you're fishing local events here in Canada, generally, they pay anywhere from $1,000 event up to and around $13,000 for a standard event, Canadian. If you have sponsors, then your sponsors will throw in what they call contingency money. So depending on where you place, the sponsors will chip in a certain amount of money and or product. If you fish a series, generally the final or the finale, you fish a two-day event, and usually the prize is either a cash prize, upwards of $20,000 to $60,000 Canadian, or it can be a brand new boat, trailer, and motor of equal value. Now, if you're fishing south of the border in the U.S. and you get on one of the professional trails, then every tournament pays upwards of $150,000 U.S. And when you go into the final there, you can win up to $1 million U.S.
That was my interview with Malcolm Jacobs, and now for Jacques Sauvet. Okay, so we'll start off with, have any companies sponsored you for fishing?
Okay, well, right now I can tell you I've got a total of, I just want to be sure of my thing, I got six sponsors right now.
Yeah. Do you know the names of them?
Yeah, I can give you, yeah. Okay, so the primary one is Shimano,
mm-hmm.
G. Loomis.
All right.
Power Pro, Jackal,
mm-hmm.
Fairmont Hotels and Resorts. Mercury.
Yeah.
Raisin River Marina.
For the next question, how old were you when you started doing tournaments?
Tournaments, you know what? Funny, I was, my first tournament, I must have been, God, I want to say 40. My first official big tournament, you know, I did that with your dad.
Yeah.
About 40 years old. Yep.
Do you have anything to say to, I don't know, beginner fishermen that might want to get into doing tournaments or, I don't know, make a living out of it, get sponsors or whatnot?
Oh, absolutely. The one number word of advice I would say is to take it slow. And if it's something that person really loves to do and they have a passion for it, take it step by step and start by targeting what companies would you like to represent or the questions you ask yourself. Because that's how I was when I started. I wasn't too sure how this worked. And the way it does work is start getting in with people that, you know, are surrounded by the products that you like. Mm-hmm. Start getting to know them, get friendly with them, and show them that you're passionate about the sport. And that'll go a long way in getting you a sponsorship.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
That's perfect. Has there been any, like, things that you found difficult in tournaments? And, like, what would be the hardest part about doing a tournament to you?
Yeah. Okay. Hardest part is it involves so much practice, and I can't stress this enough. I'm still learning till this day, but it's the time you put on the water is really what gives you your success. But the most difficult thing to answer your question is you could spend hours on a lake trying to figure it out, and tournament day comes and the weather throws you a curveball or the fish are just not on the patterns that you were doing, that can let you down really quick. That is extremely hard to swallow. And it does happen quite a lot.
Yeah.
It's tough. It is a very tough sport when you get into really competitive fishing. It's to that extent.
With this information, do you think you have what it takes to be a professional angler? My name's Dylan Jacobs. You've been listening to John Abbott on the Air, CQUT 90.3 FM. Thank you.
Hi, this is Zachary Fleury, speaking for 90.3 FM, CKUT. With the coronavirus pandemic hitting in the very beginning of spring 2020, Sure Shack owners were left to close during their most busy and profitable time of the year. As spring blooms and the very first days of warmth arrive in the Belle Province, the maple syrup industry begins their seasonal work. As the sap from the trees finally begins to flow, and the Quebecois families plan out their annual tradition of visiting their local Sugar Shack. In 2020, this tradition was left on hold, as did business for Sugar Shack owners, who have been one of the worst hit industries since the pandemic began. With coronavirus cases on the rise during the first months of 2021, most regions of Quebec have been on lockdown, which has left Sugar Shack owners scrambling to reimagine their business as they go a second season without their loyal clientele. I had the chance to speak to Stéphane Fauché, whose family owns the Sucrerie La Montagne in the Vaudreuil-Soulanges area, and hear how his Sugar Shack has been able to continue business, and especially how this year has compared to last year, where their sugar season was brought to an abrupt end.
Right, well, this year we were able to prepare, and customers were also better prepared at buying our frozen Sugar Shack meals that they could prepare at home. So this year was a much larger success than last year from that standpoint. Last year we offered frozen meals to prepare at home, but people had to come pick them up here. And it worked a lot with groups that we had canceled, people that we had to cancel the reservations. So they came and bought boxes to take home and prepare at home. And then this year we had a lot more time to prepare. And I think people were in the state of mind that they knew that Sugar Shacks might not be opening this year. And we sort of had the feeling that it was back in January and February of this year, we wouldn't kind of saw that it was leading towards that. And so we got involved in Ma Cabane à la Maison, wonderful project that was proposed to us by their creators. And we jumped in and we're so glad we did.
Because they played a huge role not only in the marketing and advertising for Skleklila Modang's meals, but also in the distribution of them. You had access to sell them in your local metro stores.
That's right.
And having a platform for it, I imagine.
Yeah, that helped a lot too. So yeah, all those things are true. 67 Sugar Shacks, I believe, was the final count of the number of participating Sugar Shacks in the movement, Ma Cabana à la Maison. And they were very, very good at promoting online, on social media, on TV and on radio. And they were very, very efficient at that. And so we all bought the same boxes and bought the containers that went along with the theme, and then we were very, very proud. We proposed that they film the show here, so they had a live show. They filmed musicians playing live at our Sugar Shack. So four different artists, French-Canadian artists, played, and those who bought the boxes online were able to get the link to the two-hour show that they could watch as they were eating their meals at home.
To give a real authentic feel to the Kiban and the Quebec culture.
Exactement.
Yeah. Wait. One of the fears as well, maybe not a fear, but definitely an impact that Sugar Shack owners are wary about COVID's impact on Sugar Shacks, isn't only the lack of business, but also there's a fear of losing a part of culture, a part of tradition of having Sugar Shacks. So it's obviously just a very important part of Quebec culture. It being one of the main aspects of Quebec culture.
Right, and that did play a role in the organizing Sugar Shacks of this movement, that
integrated.
Worry
yeah.
integrated into creating this. And also because some were seeing, well, you know, if we can't pay the accumulated bills, will we have to close if we don't have enough income, enough customers coming? So all that played a role
into
creating
how,
this event. And it also played a role in us doing a small soup and sandwich takeout menu for hikers that would come by and continue to have the maisonette d'antan, our little cabins, where we could have accommodation.
You guys
so, you know, we're in survival mode, and we did really, really well for all those reasons, but not as well as a normal sugar season, sugaring off season. So,
according to the president of l'Association des salles de réception et rabières du Québec, Stéphanie Lorrain, 75% of sugar shacks are at risk of disappearing forever.
Oui, exactement, je vous le confirme. Il faut comprendre qu'au Québec, nous sommes près de 7400 producteurs de sirop d'érable. De ce nombre, nous sommes seulement 200 cabanes à sucre à propager les savoir-faire agricoles autour de l'érable. Donc, sur les 200 cabanes à sucre du Québec, je vous confirme qu'à l'heure actuelle, malheureusement, nous en avons déjà perdu une quarantaine au combat et d'autres se posent sérieusement de grandes questions.
The loss of a second sugar season comes also to the detriment of tourism in Quebec, as the industry creates a yearly revenue surpassing the 300 million. The loss of jobs, businesses, and especially of an imaginable damage to the Quebecois culture and tradition is what is most feared, as Sugar Shack owners have missed two seasons and wait patiently for the outcome of 2022. This has been Zachary Fleury speaking for 90.3 FM CKUT. Don't forget to support our local businesses this year and the ones upcoming. You can support Sucrerie La Montagne by visiting them and ordering their takeout meals at 300 Chemin Saint-Georges in Rigaud, whose forest is directly related to the hiking trails of L'Escapade. Thank you for listening.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is John Abbott on the air. I'm Evie Stockvis. See you next time.
Alors, comme nous connaissons aujourd'hui, il y a un grand tremblement de terre frappé Haïti. Ce n'est pas différent avec un tremblement de terre du 12 janvier en 2010, là, qui était à 7,2. Alors, c'est vraiment grave. C'est vraiment grave. C'est un bouleversement avec les conditions qu'on connaît en Haïti. Et c'est la panique en totale. Et il faut point dire non, du côté département Nippon Sud, et d'après toute information qui vient joindre nous, et les cailles en Jérémie sont les plus touchées, mais c'est à travers le pays. Avec des correspondants que nous parlons en Haïti, j'ai eu la chance de faire un bon parler avec Michel Souka, nous vérifier avec nos correspondants du côté de Jérémie, malheureusement pas de circuit. Et même le cap haïtien a été touché, pas trop fort, mais Port-au-Prince et les environs, c'est très touché. C'est vraiment grave, c'est vraiment grave. Alors moi, quoi que Haïti, encore une fois, a besoin l'aide de la communauté internationale, pas pour régler des questions d'élection de la politique, mais pour aider. Et son l'autre reconstruction, son l'autre reconstruction qui va le faire. C'est en pile en émotion depuis très tôt ce matin. Et nous, notre téléphone, pour nous vérifier, nous